Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
I'll be glad to, you know,
I could ask you questions forever.
Because, well, you see, and I could talk about kids forever because I could talk about the children that I grew up with in the industry, like Judy and Jackie Cooper and Mickey Rooney and Jane Withers. Because right now there's a writer and myself, my agent, we're going to meet in the morning. We're putting together a special. And it's a special based on now and then. The kids I've been associated with now, what they're doing, and we're going to go right to them. And I'm going to talk with them, and we're going to reminisce, but we're going to go right to Jackie Cooper while he's directing Judy. We're going to go right to Jane while she's out at her house checking her doll collection. We're going to go right to Mrs. Black, and I'll talk about the comedy I did with her, a series of comedies, when the director went up to the producer and said, "You better sign that little girl." You know, she was only 4. And the producer, I remember E.H. Allen saying, "What for? She's going to outgrow that cuteness." Mm-hmm. And so who needs her? You know, we'll get another to replace her. That was Shirley Temple. She was working for $15 a week, and they wouldn't sign her for $75 a week. She went to Fox, you know the rest of the story. I mean, that's what we're going to do now. So I can go back and start wherever you want to start. Myself as a kid.
Why don't we start from where are you from, and what was your childhood like, and how did you get into the entertainment world?
Okay, I'm the youngest of a family of 4 children, and from the first time I became aware of having mixed emotions about my mother, that I was the one that was the quotes baby end quotes of the family, and the older brother was the violinist who was getting all the attention, going on the road and sending the money home, and he was the fair-haired boy until I started to make my mark in either screaming, yelling, or doing magic tricks. And that, I think, was the first thing I started to do was sing. And my mother liked that because she was a big fan of Al Jolson's. And then, of course, she started to find the songs that he sang, you know, that were famous then in the late 20s or early 30s. And I used to kind of imitate him as a little boy. Well, there were thousands of Jolson imitators, but at that time, it was a big thing for a little boy of, 7 or 8, to do an imitation of Al Jolson and win his first prize in an amateur show at the Strand Theater, which was the first theater stage I ever went on. The night they had the amateur contest, and I fell asleep in my folks' arms in the audience and ran up the aisle and got on stage. And I think half of the reason I won was because they were laughing at my being half asleep and trying to sing at the same time. And also trying to play this little tin fiddle, which I think, as I look back now, was out of jealousy of my older brother. Just a tin little, one of these tin toy fiddles. So between the screechy fiddle, my yawning, and trying to sing Let Me Sing and I'm Happy, or Mammy, I Want to Sing About You, or anything like that, I won $5. And that started my career. From that point, I started doing little shows around Pottsville, Pennsylvania. And incidentally, my dad was a tailor, and he made the clothes. He made the uniforms for Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey's father. See, Tommy and Jimmy were then young kids, and they played in their dad's band in Shenandoah, and also Alan Jones' dad. And Alan came from Shenandoah, Pennsylvania. So whenever anything ever played in these 60s and, you know, whatever, in the 40s and 50s, whenever it played Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, the Strand Theater, it was always hometown boy or hometown star, Alan Jones, or hometown Tommy Dorsey's and Jimmy Dorsey or Sidney Miller. Yeah. And after a while, my mother was very ambitious, and she did some acting and so forth. And my dad loved show business and so on. So I began picking it up here and there. And I was carted off to New York City to do a program on Sunday morning called The Children's Hour, which was sponsored by Horn and Hardart. Horn and Hardart. Something like that. They're the people that own the cafeterias. And the Sunday morning program was a little variety program. And I did that and kept commuting back and forth. I'd find myself being awakened at 4 a.m, 5 a.m. to get on the train, get up and go on the train and go to the thing. That wasn't so good, but by the same token, I did it. And once I started showing off, as you well know, and getting applause and laughter, then I thought, hey, this must be the way to go. So I was doing more playing on a stage and in parties and affairs than I was playing on the baseball field or in school. But it was all part of being a little ham, you know, show business. There was a scout from Warner Brothers Studios at one of the broadcasts at WJZ in New York, who convinced my mother, and it didn't take much convincing, that she ought to, for her health, go out to California, take me with her, and go to Warner Brothers Studio to apply for a test for a picture called Penrod and Sam with Leon Janney. Now, they've since made that picture over again 3 times. But I came to California in 1930, and my mother and I, we settled in a little place after we checked into the Garden Court Apartments in the Roosevelt Hotel and saw all the stars coming to an affair and so on. We wound up near the Paramount Studios, across the street, right aside of the old Blatt's restaurant. And eventually, I met a casting director there, who I still know today. He's a director, a friend of mine, Hollingsworth Morse. And he started getting me around to the different directors and producers. And I started working little bits here and there, even after Penrod and Sam. I did bits there, and then I worked up the street. I went on an interview and was picked to work in a gang with Mickey Maguire in a series of comedies. Mickey Maguire later became Mickey Rooney, who was alias Joe Yule Jr. And as kids, as boys in there, we were about, well, maybe Mickey's close to my age now, which I won't give you on tape. We paddled around together. Our mothers became friends. I stayed at his house, went down to the beach. And, you know, as kids get together and go to the fun houses and so on. And Mickey and I became very fast friends. See, those comedies, they were like our gang comedies, you know. Half of them were made up on the spot, just like you'd make up little things, which today they call improvisation. In those days, we just say, make it up, you know. Let's make it up. You be this and I'll be that, and you say this and I'll say that. And see, after a while, sometimes I tend to skip. I don't know what might be interesting to you.
You stayed in contact with Mickey Rooney?
Yes, and we're still friends today. He calls me about every 30 days or so. He'll call me from long distance, tell me about 2 ideas for a play, 5 ideas for a motion picture, 10 ideas for a television series, 1 idea for a hamburger stand, 2 ideas for another business, a tape, learning to act by tape.
Supposedly have retired.
No, no way.
No way.
No way.
I knew that when I heard it.
No way. That's, no. I don't think Mickey will ever retire. Anyway.
You mentioned an early on the children's TV show you hosted. What did you do between that and Mickey Mouse Club along the children's line?
Well, from then on, I became involved in motion pictures and worked freelance as a kid actor. And then Warner Brothers signed me to a contract, and I had the good fortune of working with people, or if I didn't work with them in a movie as a kid actor, I went on the stage and watched them. And by them I mean Edward G. Robinson, Paul Muni, which I did a picture called Hi Nelly with Paul Muni, in which I played the office boy. Kay Francis, and what was her name?
Ann Bancroft?
No, that's before Ann Bancroft. Not Ann Jeffries. She did a picture called Something in Petticoats. Ann Sheridan.
Oh.
It was that era, you know, of Warner Brothers stars. Garfield, Cagney. So while I was there, I got one of the leads in a picture called Mayor of Hell. And that was a big part.
Yeah.
And I met Jimmy Cagney. And I was a big fan.
Oh, yeah.
He was an idol. And so I went from that into a picture called City for Conquest. And as a kid actor, they kept using me in different things. Until one night, one day rather, one of the production men on the studio lot stopped me and said, you know, you remind me of Mervyn LeRoy. You're like a little Mervyn. Mm-hmm. We're giving a stag party for him at the Hillcrest Country Club, and we want you to do a sketch. I was about 15 now. Mm-hmm. And so I was the only kid at Mervyn LeRoy's pre-wedding party doing a sketch that they had written, and that was quite an honor. And I've got a still of that affair with Jack Warner, Eddie Cantor, Dick Powell, Lloyd Bacon, the director, and Michael Curtiz, Frank McHugh, Alan Jenkins, Jimmy Cagney. All of these people in that still that were there, you know. And for me at 15, I was like with my mouth open, you know. I've got this on my wall. It's a collage of me there with all these people, Busby Berkeley and so forth, who I worked with later when I went to MGM. After I grew up and got into kind of the awkward area, I started to do some radio work. They had a program coming on KFWB called the Marco Juvenile Review. And that was a kid show starring really most of the kids that became stars later. Jane Withers. Mm-hmm. And she and I did a kind of a Burns and Allen, George Burns, Gracie Allen, mm-hmm. as kids. Shirley was on one, Temple. And that's a funny way to phrase it. Shirley was on one, Temple. Mm-hmm. Jackie Cooper. Edith Fellows. I don't know if you ever remember her.
I don't remember Edith Fellows.
Edith Fellows, a little, she sang opera. Anyway, that went on. We got paid $10 a show and all the dog food we could eat, you know. Marco dog food. During those years, I became associated with a program that emanated from Beacon Storage on Highland and Hollywood called Bill Sharple's Breakfast Club. And I was going to junior high school part of the time and having school on a set. And I sang and played guitar, four-string guitar, and was doing my Jolson imitation when Jolson called me. He called the station and spoke to me, and it was later written up. Because I told it to Sidney Skolsky, who today still does magazine writing. You know, don't get me wrong, I love Hollywood. That's his column.
What did he say?
Well, he said, young man, he said, this is...
Did they say Al Jolson's on the phone?
Yeah. They told, they said...
He already knew who it was.
The women, well, he told him. He said, and they let me talk to him after the show. And Byron Folly said, he says, well, he was sitting at home with his, what was his wife, whoever. And he said, he thought I would get a kick out of hearing from him. And I was delirious. And the ironic thing about it is that later on in years, I met Jolson, and I also met his Ruby Keeler's sister, who I dated. So when we dated steadily, I used to talk to Jolson all the time. And he was a very great favorite of mine. I may sound like I'm skipping.
It's all right.
Because I just, you know, as things come to my mind.
Yeah.
I did a lot of early radio, and I remember just the other day when I went in to get some film at Beacon Storage and was in that building, I said to Donald O'Connor's wife, who was there with me, I said, in this very building, not only did I do the little broadcast breakfast program, but I also did the first television show with Rudy Vallee. The hot lights, a little tiny studio. Felt like being inside of Earl Scheib's oven to paint cars, you know, those big floodlights.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me just rest for a moment. Turn that off for a second. Get my... Okay. After a lot of years in pictures as a freelance actor, I became associated with many of the kids in movies at the time, like Jackie Cooper. We became very good friends. Jane Withers, and Shirley Temple, Virginia O'Brien, Benita Granville, the Mock Twins, all Jackie Cyril, all the young stars. They're not like today, you know. You don't find any young kid stars today except John Travolta, but that's already 20, 21. Talking about real 10-year-old, 11-year-old kid stars, they're not around. It's not the trend. Anyway, Mickey eventually was signed at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and I signed a stock contract with seven other people four boys and four girls, became stock players at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And that's when I met Busby Berkeley again. And he directed all the musicals, you know, most of them. And I worked as a bit player and supporting player to Mickey Rooney there with Judy. And that's when we all became very fast friends. And Judy and I became very friendly. I loved her very much. And she confided in me about her early days with psychiatry. And how she, you know, just was in love with love. And she always told me about her love for Dave Rose and different people that she, you know, went with. And she was always a great person to talk to. And to sometimes she'd call me up in the middle of the night. She was a ham, radio ham. And she loved working with that set of hers and talking to people all around the world, because she had insomnia terribly. And during all those pictures, like Strike of the Band, Babes in Arms, we always had some great parties. I mean, really great parties, where in those days there was no drinking, there was no smoking weed or anything like that. It was just great fun to be in a group together and put on little shows like you do with puppets, singing, dancing, making up little playlets, improvising these little things, and, you know, pretending to be characters. And they were fabulous parties. I mean, it wasn't just eating ice cream and, you know, most of the kids performed and also exchanged little ideas and so on. I was at Metro for quite a number of years, and Archie Mayo, who directed Boys Town, see, I finally got into Boys Town and did a lead in that picture, and then later on, I was called back to do the sequel. In between that time, I created a vaudeville act and went out and did impressions. I did a single, and I went out and I was headlining on the stage in vaudeville all around the states. Chicago, St. Louis, Dayton, Ohio, where the Wright brothers were born. At least they flew their first plane. State and Lake in Chicago, I think I said that. Adams Theater in Newark, and all those vaudeville houses. I played on a bill with Vilma and Buddy Ebsen. That's when Buddy was a vaudeville actor. And we've talked about that many times. Let's see. Where else can we go? As long as I'm on vaudeville, that's how I met Donald O'Connor. I used to go to the Orpheum Theater every Monday night to guest star night. And they always had 10 extra acts of vaudeville. And during one of those Monday nights, the O'Connor family appeared. And Donald was the head of the act. He used to throw them all over the place. And that thing that he did in the Strike of the Band, I mean, I'm sorry, in Singing in the Rain, where he crawls up the wall and flips over, he used to do that in his act, in the O'Connor family act. In the vaudeville act, yes, on stage. And we were so flipped by his work that we used to go backstage. And we met and so forth, you know, and as kids do, they, at least we decided that we'd, you know, try to get in touch with each other through our parents and so on. And it was shortly afterward that I did a benefit, my first very thrilling benefit, doing my impressions, was at the Biltmore Bowl in Los Angeles with Bob Hope, Sophie Tucker, Ethel Merman, and the O'Connor family and Red Skelton, and I was on the bill, and it was a big thrill. Because I was then about 18, I guess. And interesting what flashed into my mind. Because I, even though I'm skipping, nowadays, when I run into people who I talk to like you, and they're in awe of all these combination of names and people that I was associated with, they wonder why, as I do, things have changed so much. And I say, well, it's a changing world, you know. However, I find the resistance to a lot of those things comes around when, for instance, I am submitted to a particular producer to direct something. And one moment before that, I may have been in a cafe, as I am with you, and I've had someone come up and say, what is your name? And I'd say, Sidney Miller. We've seen you in so many wonderful, why don't we see you anymore? Or you've given us so much pleasure, and why, you must have been in this business for, I said, yes, all my life, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and all this ego praise. And then a little later, you're in talking to a producer who says to you, what have you done? Mm-hmm. And says to me, what have you done? And you say, beginning when? You know, and they become a little sensitive about that, as you are, as one, as I have been sensitive, about, I know some of my chums as well as me, being referred to as old hat, or old-fashioned, or square, and so forth, which isn't the case at all, because I appreciate the fact that when I was 18 and 20 and 25, I wanted to, you know, be right up there with the olders, the oldies, you know, the guys that were 40 and 50 and so on. I won't tell you how old I am. However, I think if you, you know, this is in my own defense, I stay alive and like staying alive, you know, like Saturday Night Fever, listening to records. My stepson keeps me up on the music. My son is in Saturday Night Fever, played the third lead.
What is his name?
Barry Miller. And I keep up with what's happening. And I think that men in my category, in my bracket, are some of them, the who are directing now as I am and writing. I think we have acquired a lot of the knowledge and experience that can be utilized as much as, if not more than, some of the guys who only get hired because, or get hired more so because they happen to be in today's age bracket. I don't think age is where it's at. See, these are my feelings. I think experience is where it's at. Because I've seen guys that are 25 that go around like 60-year-old men. You'll have some guys 60 who go around like,
that's right, going
15, up 18, they're little boys. I know Walt Disney was like that. He was a grown-up little boy. A lot of the little boy in him came out.
What was that first contact? How did that happen?
Okay. I had been doing the Colgate Comedy Hour with O'Connor, as you know, many years, 9 years. where I can see the songwriter's bit along with Sid Culler. And after about five seasons, I staged the songwriter's bits, and Joe Bigelow, one of the producers at NBC, saw me working, staging the bits that Donald and I were doing, along with Donald O'Connor. And he offered me a job directing the Saturday Night Review, one of the first television shows. Replacement for the Saturday Night Review that Max Liebman did. Well, my agent got wind of the Disney Studios planning a Mouseketeers show. And I heard nothing about it. They did their first season, and evidently Walt was not satisfied with two or three of the segments, because he had segments on every night, every day of the week. Incidentally, they've been re-released. Do you know that? Do you know that the original Mouseketeers, see, they try to bring back, they try to bring the new, make new Mouseketeers this last 2 years.
That's right, I've seen it.
Didn't work.
No.
But they re-released the old ones,
yeah.
And the old ones are one of the highest rated kid shows in television.
That's right.
And I did
hundreds of them. They're not here
locally
now. No. They were.
Syndication, yeah.
In fact, when I was up in your apartment that last time, you were on the phone trying to negotiate, trying to get some residual payments.
Right.
With your agent.
Couldn't do it.
Yeah. You were perturbed about that.
Right,
at the time.
Right, right. Well, I was called to go out to the studio and meet Mr. Disney and the executive producer on the Mouseketeers show. They wanted a man to come and direct the kids who had some experience in musical comedy to do the Mondays and Tuesday and Wednesday night segments. So,
you were ideal because you were a child actor yourself and you
right.
known that whole gamut.
That's how he felt.
Yeah.
It sounded just like him. So, we talked and he said, well, let him do two of them. He said to the executive producer, let's Sidney direct two of them, let's see what they are, what they're like. So I directed two segments, after which they signed me for a year. And by year, I mean 26 weeks. And I worked there doing those segments and became very close to Walt.
Well, tell me about that first meeting with Walt. I mean, you had always known who he was and admired his work, I'm sure.
Yeah.
How did you first meet him? Did he walk on the set when you were directing the first one?
No, he was sitting in the meeting when I first came in the meeting to interview me.
I see.
And while the executive producers under him were questioning me, so was he. And I was in awe, you know, of this great man. But he became...
Were you nervous?
I don't remember being too nervous.
Just in awe.
I was a little uptight, I guess, when I think back about it. But after a while, he just made me feel like he was just another kid.
Mm-hmm.
And what I loved about his approach was that he wanted kids to be natural,
mm-hmm. yeah.
real, and like the boy next door, not like little Meglin kiddies. Well, I'll take that back, but not like little overly made up,
right.
stilted, you know, taught by the parent how to gesture and so all that junk.
Right.
You know, false.
Something that the everyday child could relate to.
Still talented, you know, still sing and talk.
Still sells.
And you know, and act, but natural. You know, a real natural feel is the way he liked to have the kids. So I stayed there for 1 year and they signed me for another year. And I directed Annette Funicello and Cubby O'Brien and all the kids. And that was a fun couple of years.
Now, I have a lot of questions about this area.
Okay.
What was the first thing you did as a director? What was the first dance you worked on?
All right.
I mean, what did you develop any of these things yourself, or
strangely enough,
write any of the songs?
Yeah, a lot. There's a lot of questions. There's four questions. I can answer one at a time. All right. My first job as the director was Saturday Night Review, to direct everything, sketches and the choreography and so forth. But I had people under me, or I should say assisting me, in the various departments. Now, when I went to Columbia Studios, my agent put me in touch with a producer named Lou Breslow, who gave me a chance, an opportunity, to direct one Damon Runyon Theater. With my experience as an actor and as whatever I was as then, I did one Damon Runyon Theater, and from that I got the whole 13 to do, working every other show on film. And that was just directing actors to act and go by the script. When I directed at Disney's, it was to direct the musical comedy aspects, so that I picked songs, wrote songs, worked with a choreographer, and became involved in the musical comedy areas. At that time, I guess, or before, I started writing songs as a hobby. I wrote my first song with Mickey Rooney called Have a Heart, and then a song called Oceans Apart, which Judy recorded. Judy Garland, Oceans Apart. And I still get little royalty checks today. A copy sells here, a copy there, or a record here or there. 40 cents here, a dollar and a half here. Pardon me.
It's nice to be reminded of that.
Right. And what started out as an avocation became a vocation. Mickey and I wrote a lot of songs together. And our first big published tune that made some noise was a song called Have a Heart. Kay Kaiser introduced that. And then we wrote a song called Love's Got Nothing on Me. And Mickey would rather write a hit song at that time than be number one at the box office, which he
was. There's something magic about writing this
song.
Yeah,
he was number one for 5-6 years, more than that, above Gable and above everybody at Metro. It's hard to know where to go.
We skipped around, but let's talk about some of the songs you wrote for the Mickey Mouse Club.
Okay, well, most of those songs were written for the whole series, were written by Tom Adair. However, I worked on the special material. The songs that were published were mostly songs that I later had written with Inez James for the Donald O'Connor, Peggy Ryan pictures, which we haven't talked about. They were songs like, I don't know whether you'd know them, but Come to Baby Do, My Fickle Eye, I Waited a Little Too Long, Ockle Baby Dockle, that I wrote for Betty Garrett and Margaret O'Brien, that was at Metro. Have a Heart, I said, yeah. I Realize Now, that Nat Cole recorded. Well, most of those songs, and there were a lot of picture songs that were just in the sequences. that weren't really popular. They were written for that sequence, like Prince of Ophelia and Fellow with a Flute, things like that, that weren't known. However, I became an ASCAP member 35 years ago, whichever year that was, and I just kept writing songs, lyrics, with different writers. Ray Gilbert wrote Zippity Doodah. Was a very dear friend of mine. He's passed away. And I wrote hundreds of songs.
But now, you handle all those talents, shows, and like a song like Today is Tuesday, for instance, that was already written before you had come there, or?
Oh, the theme for Today's Tuesday? Yeah, that was done.
And when you came to that segment, you had directed that, even though it was written by somebody else. Did you direct that every time?
No. They used the same title.
The same tape
for title. Oh, yeah, that was always a step piece.
And that was worked out before you had come, that tape?
Let's see, Today for Tuesday was the one with the all cast on camera, doing the marching and the movie. Now, Monday night, we did a whole new opening that I directed. Tuesday, I think that one was done.
I remember seeing you once doing Invitations on that
right,
show.
Right, I was on camera for several of them. I directed myself, yeah. Now, that was done fresh.
Every one of the tapes that I, every one of my interviews, they have usually some fantastic, funny story. Can you think of anything with working with any of those people?
So many things happen. I think about the funniest and most embarrassing. Oh, you mean the Mouseketeers?
Yes.
Oh, there were so many funny things on that set, things that happened, backfired and so forth, that I'd have to search into my memory bank, which right now needs a deposit, to coin a phrase, that's good. Makes a lot of sense. We could go on like this.
I'm sure the Mouseketeers were not always so agreeable as we see them. I mean, long hours on the set.
On the whole, they were amazingly agreeable for one reason. The mothers stayed in the other set. They were never allowed on the stage.
Oh, really?
Walt Disney had a special stage for mothers. So there were never the jealousies going on and so forth.
Yes.
And the coaching and the, you know, prompting.
It's really a lot of attention, yeah.
One funny story that comes to mind was not on the Mouseketeers set, but was on the Boys Town set. We had already done the one feature, and 2 years went by to be called back to do the second. Well, I inherited thin hair from my father. I mean, my dad lost his hair at 25, and my brother's hair went thin. So at a very early age, I started thinning at the part. When I went back to see Mr. Turog, the director, he noticed my hair thinning and sadly but truly told me he'd have to have the makeup man make a hairpiece for me. Well, in those days they called it toupee, and at the sound of the word I got ill and got so I cried to think that I would be among my peers and colleagues and kids and friends with a toupee on. But he made me realize it would only be slight and very small and just enough to keep me as youthful as the other fellas. So I agreed, of course. If I hadn't agreed, I wouldn't have worked. After it was made for me and I was shown, you know, how to put it on, if not have it put on by the makeup man, the day of shooting came, and of course, as you know, most things are shot out of sequence. The opening day's work was done at the graveside of the little dog. Remember the dog being run over? I don't know whether you'd remember that. Bobsy Watson crying. And I had to come into the scene and say to Mickey, Father Flanagan, no, I'm sorry, he came into me and said to me, Mo, Father Flanagan wants you in the office right away. It was a windy day that day. And I had just come from the makeup department, had the piece put on. Standing out and back, it took the director at least 20, 25 minutes to get little Bobsy Watson to cry. And the whole set was very silent, very quiet. And through his sobs, you could just hear a pin drop. So the assistant called for the scene to roll. And Mr. Turok said, action. And I hear this scream, cut, cut. And he came over to me and put his arm around me. And Mickey just broke up. I mean, he just got hysterical. Because he came and couldn't say his line. He says, Mo, Father Flanagan. What's the matter with you? The director said, Sidney, you just waved at the camera. The whole hairpiece, the little piece, was flipping in the wind. And I was so embarrassed that I just turned my head in shame. And to make matters worse, the hairdresser, the lady hairdresser, came over and put bobby pins in my hair to hold the hairpiece down on my head. And the next day when I came to work, they had a head block with a Groucho Marx's wig on with a sign saying, don't touch Sidney Miller, you know. So it was an incident I remember. Other things were just a lot of fun. I don't know.
Do you have a particular Walt Disney story that you like to tell?
Yes, one I think that is so typical of the man. They decided to have me direct the Zorro, I mean not Zorro, but the Walt Disney's birthday special. And it was his idea, and Bill Walsh's idea, to walk into an empty soundstage while he was just strolling around the lot. And he would come in on this empty, empty stage, thinking about what he was planning to do. And then he'd walk over and sit on a chair, a director's chair, which was just planted in the middle of the stage with very dim light flashing by. And suddenly a little voice from off camera would say,
happy birthday, Walt. Happy birthday.
And you look up and come to Mickey on top of a ladder. A real ladder, but Mickey animated. And Walt saying, how'd you know it was my birthday?
Oh, I follow my...
You know, he is... anyway, make a long story short. He planned this whole thing. It was all written and all planned out. And I would shoot these different segments at a different time and shoot him at a different time. Well, in our discussion with the writers and with Bill Walsh, it was decided that he wanted Zorro to do his own sound. He didn't want them to do like they do on the car commercial now. He wanted, for some reason, Guy to do it, ha ha, like a ha, you know, but to do it making the sound of a Z. So in the meeting with the writers, he demonstrated, like a little boy, you know. When the meeting was over, we went ahead and kept on preparation. And one day I got to work, and if you know the Disney Studios, well, I'm sure you do, you walk down a long hallway where all the workers go into that one building that his office is in, and you turn into the elevator and go upstairs, where my office was in Bill Washington. Well, here he is. I'm coming out of the elevator, whatever it was. He's going the other opposite way, and we cross each other in the hall. Good morning, Walt. Good morning, Sydney. And after he got past me, and crowds of people, visitors as well as employees, standing in the hall, and he turns around and over the heads yells, "Sydney!" And I turn, he says, "Don't forget, when Zorro wields his sword, I want him to go, ha, ha, ha." And he does this thing, and people, visitors, and employees alike, looking at this man like a little boy, like a kid doing an imitation of his one of his characters. And I never forgot that. It was such a kick that, you know, he had no inhibitions about acting like a little kid when it came to demonstrating the things he wanted. And I think the studio misses him today. You know, I don't think his touch is there on a lot of stuff. I think, you know, he was a very unusual man. Although some of the creators carry on his style, he had a great influence on those people.
Did you have a favorite of the Mouseketeers?
Not particularly a favorite. They were all such good kids and such fun. Annette Funicello, I liked very much from the beginning. Cubby O'Brien was another favorite. I still know Cubby. He's with the singing group now that's so famous. Carpenters. He's their drummer. Good drummer.
And he was a good drummer back then,
too. Yeah. As a matter of fact, how the wheel turns. I've done the affiliate show for ABC, doing the special lyrics for 3 years now. And when we made a demonstration record, Cubby came in to do the drumming.
Really?
You know, so yeah. I keep running into these kids all the time.
Of course, you work with Sharon at the Crofts all the time.
Right? Sharon and I run into each other.
I've been doing the Renaissance Pleasure Fair, and Dennis Day is down there.
Dennis,
one of the coordinators.
Right. Yeah, I see Janie Withers. I run into the... It's a kick to run into them again and work. I've worked with Jackie Cooper again, you know, and I used to do a lot with him.
How did it come down to the show being canceled? How did that work out? Being canceled, the Mickey Mouse Club.
Well, I guess they just, again, thought that was old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
They probably thought, you know, the great producers that know what the people want thought that was old hat. It isn't at all, because, you know, for a certain group of people, those kids were very real and very natural, and the ears still sell at Disneyland more than anything else sells in any toy store. Those Mouseketeers.
Were you really hurt? Yeah, I've seen it everywhere.
Yeah.
Were you really hurt that you didn't get any residual payments?
Yes, I was. It hurt quite a bit. But it was no one's fault, except the agents that knew.
Yes.
All those people that signed on a basis of being paid a salary above the scale salaries. which then gave them the right to say that this would in turn take care of any residual payment in the future for a period of X amount of years.
Yeah.
That they would be repeating those shows.
Tell me about Roy Williams. Have you still been in contact with him?
Roy, I think, is gone.
Oh, did he pass away?
I heard, yet.
Yeah. It must have been just recent.
Jimmy Dodd did, too. You know,
yeah, that was pretty
but I guess
ago.
It was recent. Maybe you're right. Now, somebody said to me, though, that they thought he had passed away.
I haven't contacted any of the Disney people yet. I wanted to build a list of names before I went to them.
Oh, yeah?
So I'm ready to go to them now. I have about 40 names, good ones.
Oh, that's fine. I want to go out there and visit again. I just ran into a couple of people from there. I ran into Lou Debney. And I ran into at the Tommy Leonetti concert the other night for the Holistic Institute. I ran into Buddy Baker, the composer conductor. And I've got to run into my next appointment. It's 10 after 1 now. If there's something else at all, Paul, that I can give you on the phone, I gave you this. Now,
yes.
This is not my full bio here. Oh, those are my credits. I thought you might want that.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And then this is a kind of a capsule version of other work of me. You know, but it's not my biography.
Yes, uh-huh.
And I thought I had it in here, but I do not. If you like that, I'll get that for you.
Sure, I would.
Would you?
Yeah. If you could just run over some of the names you've done for the cross. You know, some of the names, I mean, to give you credit, some of the characters. You did
Sigmund and the Sea Monster. I did a Blurp.
Uh-huh.
Did I do Blurp? Yeah. What's the name did Slurp? I did a Blurp. I did Mama.
You know the Mama voice.
I did Mama. And then I did the uncle, and I did a couple of the doctors that came.
Mm-hmm.
What were the other characters? Blurp and Mama. And the various characters. Oh, the queen, what was her name? There was a teacher, the woman teacher. I did, you sort of Ed May Oliver, you know that voice. He did. Oh, yes, of course. Forget what her name was.
I see you did the Addams Family. What did you do on
direct.
That?
These are all directorial credits. This is all directing.
I see.
All directing.
How long was it? Just a one incidental show?
No, I did about 5 of those episodes.
And the Monkees?
Monkees, I did 2 episodes.
The Fairy Knows and Bewitched is another fantasy.
Yeah.
Please Donate the Daisies. I'll be including that. Tammy,
yeah.
Of course.
Tammy, that's where I met my second wife.
Oh, really?
My present wife was one of the leads, and I was directing her.
Uh-huh.
Made
what
a date with her, and I've been...
Her name?
Dorothy Green is her professional name. Her... married name, of course, is Dorothy Green Miller, or Dorothy Miller, and she is now given up acting as of this broadcast. No, as of this taping, she just gave up her acting career for a real estate career. She's with Coldwell Banker, one of their top leading salesmen, saleswomen, salespersons, for those women that are sensitive about being called.
My Favorite Martian is another fantasy
yes,
program.
Yes, I did many of those.
Really?
Oh, yeah, I did. A whole full series of those. Yeah.
Excellent program. Yeah. The Real McCoys, that's a nice one.
Did many of those.
Many of those.
Yeah. Did about 15 episodes of that. The producer of that show, when I did it, one of the producers was Danny, the man that's producing Barney Miller. Danny Arnold.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.